Couple of quick announcements. First of all, if anyone is free at the start of September to attend the Vanderbilt Critical Care APP Bootcamp, their terrific annual course, really intended for APPs in critical care, I will be speaking. You can see my lovely mug, and it's always a great time. Check that out. And as always, if you haven't seen the Intensive Care Academy, our video-based course, we just redesigned the whole site. It looks lovely. And there's a bunch of great new content, everything from basics A to Z and lots of specialty material. I think you'll enjoy it. CME credits too. ICU101.com for that. Otherwise, on to the show.
Hey everyone, I'm Brandon Odo.
And I'm Brian Bowling.
And this is Critical Care Scenarios, the podcast where we use clinical cases, narrative storytelling, and expert guests to unpack how critical care is practiced in the real world.
Hello everyone, welcome back to the podcast. It's Brian Bowling with you as always, and joining me is the slightly under the weather, Brandon Odo.
If you hear me coughing, it's not because of the content. It's I forgot RSV or something. But
it's,
hello,
it's
everyone.
Just he has TB. So we're going to do another episode today where we talk less about clinical topics and more about what you can do with your life. You may remember we did an episode way back when, I forget when, but we'll find and link it, on moving into academics from clinical practice. And so this is another one very similar. We're going to talk about moving into industry, I guess, is the best kind of generic catch-all. So we got a guest who's done that, and we thought we'd chat with her. So we have Teresa Heumann. She's a PharmD PhD who left the hallowed halls of clinical practice for, some would say, the greener pastures of industry, where she's now a medical science liaison for a large pharmaceutical company. So welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Brian. Thank you, Brandon.
So Teresa, just give us like the, you know, 2-minute summary of kind of the trajectory that your career had, you know, the before and the after, so to speak.
Absolutely. So I started in pharmacy school and started pursuing my PhD at that point because I really thought I wanted to do some research and development. Was sort of where I was. And then whenever I started doing my clinicals during pharmacy school, I realized I liked patients, didn't want to be in the lab anymore, but I didn't like my patients to talk. I like them to be intubated and sedated. So I went ahead and pursued then residency, where I did a critical care residency after my PGY1 down at MUSC in South Carolina. Again, really loved the neuro space at that time. And so then started my career in the clinical academic space. My first job was at in UVA, University of Virginia in Charlottesville, where I worked in the neuro ICU. Really started getting into the academic side, doing a lot of teaching, professor, writing, research, those kinds of things. Had a bunch of babies. I know that's not relevant to academics or my career, but kind of does. Had a bunch of babies. And my mom said, "You need to get closer to home. I can't help you so far away." And she said, "Come to Chicago or come to St. Louis and I'll meet you there." Dr. Derringer, who was the lead or the head of the neuro ICU at Washington University in St. Louis, Barnes Jewish Hospital, created a position for me, and all's history. Moved to St. Louis, started my career there, then again in the neuro ICU. Taking care of brain injured patients, again, continuing my academic career, teaching, education, you know, rounding every day, teaching my fellows. I loved that part of it. The fellows were fantastic and the nurse practitioners, really, it's like a family in the ICU space, really. And then after COVID, my kids, again, comes back to my kids, they all left for college and beyond. And I was very burnt out, as you can only imagine after doing 25 years of clinical. I'm sure everyone feels that. I had spent a lot of time as well sitting on the Neuro Critical Care Board of Directors, led the Guidelines Committee, et cetera, and just was really needing a change. Reached out to a couple people that I'd worked for in the past and said, love to change to the industry side. And so here I am on the quote unquote dark side. And I love it. I absolutely love it. I have to say, going into the industry side, I do, however, feel that having 25 plus years on the clinical side has really made it a much value add on the industry side. I feel like being in the critical care space, I've interacted and discussed with everyone from oncology to nephrology to hospitalists to, you name the specialty, we've dealt with that type. And I really think that just makes my role then in this industry side a lot more valuable.
So you spent about 25 years working clinically and were academically very active. And I mentioned that to reinforce that it's not like you spent a couple years and you're like ew, like clinical work is not for me. And it's funny that I feel the need to mention that, because on the one hand, what I mean is that you had a good experience for both. But on the other hand, I guess it feels like I have to justify you as having, like, putting your time in the trenches and having the moral standing to do this. And I want to sort of explore this, like, moral tone to this in a second. But suffice to say, you've seen both ways. Just let's kind of get the obvious question out of the way. What was your goal with the change? Like, what were you hoping this career transition would do for you?
I think I needed to be reinvigorated and have a different focus, I think, was all. You know, again, I love taking care of the patients. I really enjoyed getting to know the families, because, as you know, in the critical care space, it's almost just as much getting to know and interacting with the families as it is taking care of the patients. I really did love the teaching, the fellowship, the nurse practitioners, the attendings, all of the things that I did. I think there just becomes a point, though, where you need something different, right? And I know that it's ever changing. It's not like you went to work every day and it was the same thing every day, right? Just because you're rounding every day, every patient's different every day. The same patient you saw yesterday is different, right? So that it's always changing and different in the clinical space. But I think I just needed a different focus. And that was all I needed. I think I just needed to reset, I think. And if you talk to or read the literature or go to any critical care space, I think you'll find that almost every critical care clinician has burnout, right? I think that's known. We've got surveys across the board. It doesn't matter what the space is. We've got surveys. We talk to people. And I think I was just burnt out. And I think COVID really did sort of push me over the edge. I think I was starting in that space, in that trajectory. Again, COVID was different because it was a lot of longer hours. You were being expected to do things that maybe the ambulatory or administration used to do, but they were furloughed. So since you were in the hospital, you were required to do extra. So I think all of those things sort of just tilted me to needing a change. And it wasn't because I didn't like taking care of patients. It wasn't that I didn't love the fellows, right? I'm still, they still call me their, Mama T or whatever, because I was, the one that sort of took care of them. So it wasn't any of those. I think I just needed a change. And I felt like I could do that with my kids all leaving. I felt also that I could commit myself to travel for work, right? So the industry side and the medical affairs, when you're a field agent, basically, there's could be quite a bit of travel. And I didn't want to miss a lacrosse game. I didn't want to miss a soccer game. I didn't want to miss a theater presentation that they might have. And now that they were gone, I felt like, you know what, I could commit myself to whatever company I was working with and do whatever travel was necessary to make that job meaningful to everyone.
Yeah, so really just looking for something different, which, I mean, like you said, I think it's something a lot of us want. Like, if you do anything long enough, you're doing a lot of the same stuff. And it doesn't really matter if it's good or bad work or even interesting work. It's not infinite. I mean, there's only so much variation to the things that we see. Now, that being said, I mean, there's probably other transitions you could have made that would have changed it up, right? So were you specifically looking to move into the private sector? Or was this just sort of something that came along and you were like, well, why not try that?
There definitely are several things that I could have considered, and I can't say that I didn't think about others, right? So one of the pieces that I did look into was being an expert witness for whether it's the defense or prosecution, right? So as a clinician who has seen many of the things, that's one area. You do a lot of work from home, you go give depositions, you know, and I think that could be fun. And I did several of those sort of during my clinical time. I could have definitely tried to go back into the lab and use my PhD. That didn't sound very exciting to me, to be honest with you, after seeing patients and that change that happens, especially in the critical care space where everything is sort of moment to moment and you're making those decisions that are life altering, right? I don't think the lab was the place for me. And I think a good marriage then was this industry side, bringing my clinical expertise to the front, and showing people that I don't have to be biased, right? Just because I'm supporting one of the drugs in the industry doesn't mean that I can't tell where I would put it in my repertoire, right? Like, that's why I think that the individuals that I worked with in the ICU very much so took almost all of my recommendations or allowed me to just practice, right? Because they realized that I wasn't going to be biased, that I was going to take all this information. And so I think I was, it was just a good fit for me. And I like people, right? So a field job, such as a medical liaison, whether that's in a director's position, a VP level, it still deals with a lot of other HCPs across the U.S. or the globe. And so I really like to interact with all of these healthcare professionals, see what their practice is, see if there's ways that I can support them or collaborate, partnership, et cetera.
Yeah, I feel like one of the skills or the gifts you sort of develop with a longer career is a better understanding of what it is that you actually want to do or like or dislike, kind of building your own understanding of yourself that way. People who start out, they don't really know. They have this kind of dream or vision of what they want from a career, but they don't actually know. They haven't tried it. So after a while, you get this sense for like, these are non-negotiable things. I can't tolerate this. I really need this. And then that opens the door to like, well, this particular way of working that before I wouldn't have considered or I didn't think it was for me, why shouldn't that be on the table if it fits those criteria? And at the same time, you know, you're developing certain skill sets that you didn't have early on that may open doors to doing such things, really making kind of later career options, I think, look very different from they might early on. And, you know, for this kind of change, I think that especially applies because we have to sort of acknowledge that this particular shift, you know, working for private industry, pharmaceutical companies, device companies, that sort of thing, it's viewed sometimes by clinicians, and especially those working academically who are doing a lot of scholarship and teaching, as sort of the opposite end of that spectrum. Like there's something very, very noble about being an academic clinician who is taking care of patients and writing papers and sitting on committees and those sorts of things. Like those are like saving the world, whereas working for, you know, private industry is the opposite. Like maybe because there's so much money involved, maybe because the incentives are business related in general, not to say that what we do clinically is not a business as well, but we have this idea that that's not what's coming first. There's this perception that making that change is like the less moral thing to do. Like you woke up one day and decided, and before, what was important to me was helping people, and now what's important to me is making money, I guess. I mean, that's sort of what the perception is. Like, you're doing this to cash out. Yeah. And first of all, and that may not even make sense. Like, I don't even know if you're making any more money now or, you know, in a meaningful way. But I also don't know, like, morally, if there's any real difference.
You don't have
to tell us your salary. Yeah. I was like, do you need my W-2?
It's not like you're working for like you're selling blood diamonds or something, right? You know, it's you're working for a different business in the realm of like, you know, American businesses. So are these some of the thoughts that you had at that time? Was there a perception you had to grapple with, at least for yourself, or even how you thought you might be viewed by others?
Such a great question. So I will tell you, though, that in all of my years in academia/clinical space, I always met with sales representatives, other medical science industry partners, because I do think that they always can bring something to you. One of the biggest things with the neuro space, neuro ICU, is that they basically exclude your patients from every trial unless it's a neuro-specific trial, right? So sometimes I wouldn't know that there's new drugs that are out there or a new drug in a space. Then it's on me then as the clinician to decide, is this a tool I want in my toolbox? Is this a tool I could use on my patients? Just because the critical care data didn't include my patients, what does that look like from a pathophysiologic, from a receptor standpoint and how the drug works, right? So I always met with them all along. In my time in academia, though, the pendulum swung dramatically from they used to be able to take us to resorts and give us massage, and we would go golfing at Pebble Beach, and now all of a sudden, then it started swinging towards the other ways where now the industry can't give you a pin. They can't come and see you unless they have a badge that says that they gave their DNA and their firstborn to the pharmacy Scarlet department letter. Downstairs. Exactly. And so we're not going to give you food and Sunshine Act and everything. And so, yes, I think the pendulum has definitely swung over here, but I do think that there is a space, and I've always thought that there was a space for industry. I think, though, one of the things that was a little different to me is that I think that I spent so much time in the critical care / neuro ICU space giving, teaching, my Rolodex is huge of people that I've trained, people who know me, people who have led, I've led underneath or led them on committees, directed them, that I think people know me as a solid clinician, right? As somebody who is not biased. But I also have always been open about my industry participation because I think it's important. I don't think that we should let industry go. So yeah, it is something that I think, and so I come to SECM or I go to the neurocritical care and I know half of the people that are there because I've worked for them for 20 years. And so that doesn't become hard. It's when you start meeting people that maybe are newer, I haven't met, I haven't interacted with, I don't have a connection with, that sometimes I feel like maybe they're judging me as far as my choice to be in the industry space. But then I think once you talk to me and we talk about whatever the product is or whatever the disease state, I think that's when you can say, I know what the heck I'm talking about. I'm not just some dumb blonde that's out there trying to push Vibativ on my patients, right? I also think that everyone knows, and once you get to talking to me, whether it's in the industry space or whether it's on the other side, is that I do want the best for the patients, right? And if I have an antibiotic that I want to tell you about, and I don't think it's first line for your patients, I'm going to tell you, hey, I have this antibiotic. I don't think you should using it first line, but I do think you should consider it whenever you've got failures or you've got persistent bacteremia or you've got somebody with infective endocarditis or you've got somebody with septic emboli to the brain because it crosses the blood-brain barrier, right? I'm going to tell you all those reasons why, but I'm also going to tell you why I would potentially be careful of it. Right? Like, oh, it's really hard on the kidneys. Oh, it's really bad on the liver. Oh, there are some drug interactions, right? So I'm going to have a real conversation with you. And I think at the end, you're going to step away and say, I don't feel like I was just given a sales pitch. I think she just educated me like she would a resident, a fellow, a partner, a employee, whatever. So I think you have to show up and be your authentic self when you're having these conversations and talk about your drug in the context of a patient, a disease state, and in the landscape or the market basket, basically, of what you're talking about, and not just one drug.
And I have to imagine that you having a rich clinical background helps you to do that. I mean, you're able to look at a patient or a question or a situation, both from the perspective of essentially what would my companies say, like what's the party line, and also as a clinician, what do you think from wearing that hat? Whereas someone, let's say, who had no clinical experience, I don't know if someone like that would be doing your job, but they wouldn't have one of those, so all they would have is the other. And if someone was like, this is a very one note conversation, it's like, well, yes, it is.
You're saying new people just straight out of school or out of residency, maybe or maybe not, would not be in this job. I want to tell you that that is what the industry up until just recently was looking for. They were looking for non-clinical people that they could groom, the industry could groom to be their medical pillar. I do think that's changing. I think because here, I will tell you right now, like when I went to start looking for positions in the medical industry space, I would throw my CV in LinkedIn and I would get denied even an interview because the recruiters are like, oh no,
like too much experience.
She has too much experience or she doesn't have any industry experience. Right. I'm like, who needs industry experience? I have 25 plus years of taking care of patients. Like, I think that's more valuable. So I think that that is also changing with the industry. I think the industry is definitely switching over now to really take those clinicians who have been boots on the ground and now can come over to the industry side. I really think that they're finding that that is a positive value.
As in, it's like when you apply for jury duty, they want someone who doesn't know anything about the topic so they can tell you everything that you want to know. You're not bringing in your own
biases, and they want to groom you so that you're this, you know, person that is going to be almost like sales 101 or sales 102 with a little bit of background on the knowledge. But I really think that having boots on the ground, like I was saying earlier, chatting with every type of clinician, right? Whether it's infectious diseases, nephrology, endocrinology, you know, all of those spaces you chat with and interact with on a big level, right? Based on whatever the patient is. So I think that really did allow me to know a lot about a lot of areas.
So, I mean, for yourself, just looking in the mirror, did you feel like there was any change in how you perceived yourself? I mean, a lot of us, I think, put a lot of our identity into our work and, you know, as clinicians, but maybe especially when you're academically quite busy, because honestly, a lot of that work is stuff you're kind of taking on voluntarily, presumably because it's important to you, you think it's a value, or maybe because it is part of that identity. You know, you enjoy being that sort of person. And then to kind of move away from all that and to be a different person, I feel like could be a big change in at least how you view yourself. Not being able to say to yourself that you are, you know, a clinical pharmacist working in neurocritical care or whatever. I mean, did you see yourself differently?
That's a great question. So I would say no, but in my particular setting, I offloaded a lot of my things slowly. So for example, whenever I stopped my academic position at WashU, was able to hand off a lot of that stuff there, but I was still writing book chapters. I still was helping with educational products for neurocritical care. I was still mentoring people in that society. I still sat on the board of directors, of which I was the first, and I think at this point, the only person who has ever been industry on the board. So I sat on the board for an entire year. So I offloaded these things slowly. They then recruited me I was also the guidelines co-chair during my time on industry. Again, knowing that there was a conflict of interest and if there was something with my company or one of our drugs in one of the guidelines, then I would certainly recuse myself. But I still held some of those high-level titles even when I was on the industry side, which I think really helped. They did then want me to be on the foundation. So I was a trustee on the foundation. And I think after that time, I kind of was like, you know what, I'm ready to move on and do something different. So I haven't taken on any more roles. So in my perspective, I think I did my due diligence. I did what I thought I needed to do. And it just came to the point now I need to start working on different areas. So I don't know if that really answers your question, but I don't think it changed my view at all, but it also was probably because the changeover was relatively slow and I offboarded over several years and not just all at once.
Yeah. Gradual is always easier. And I think again, you know, with a longer career, people may find that things they once thought were very important to them are not as much. It maybe sometimes because you've done it. You know, you've achieved certain milestones. You never have to think, oh, that this is something I'd like to do. You did it. It's not really about continuing to do it. And also some things that, how do I put it? Like that superficially seemed to be very important to you, you maybe eventually realize they're not so important. You know, like let's say you really, really wanted early in your career to become a full professor or something like that. And then, you know, then maybe you did, or you were close to it. And then, but then you realize after 15 years, like, why? You know, what is it actually doing or going to do for me? I understand better now what my actual values are and, you know, certain, you know, titles or goals or activities or whatever, they don't actually matter to me. So maybe that's part of it as well. I'm interested that you were sort of able to continue some academic work, because I would feel like doing a lot of these things, you know, sitting on committees, writing papers, textbooks, even some teaching would be harder once you are, you know, affiliated with industry. Do you think that those doors are most of the time still open to people? If someone's like, oh, I'd like to make this my day job, but I don't want to think that I could never do any of these sorts of things anymore, because I'd always have to declare that I have this affiliation, and people would be like, ew, you're tainted.
I think that's a great question again, too. I think that those doors were made available to me, one, because I had been doing it a long time. Two, I think that I was respected in the space. Three, we worked through some conflict of interest sort of language so that anything that was could be perceived or was a part of something that I would be working with industry-wise, I would recuse myself and not be part of conversations or voting or whatever. I think the other part of that, though, too, is that in my academic space, I was almost always strictly neuro ICU with maybe some offspring with just critical care. My industry position really has nothing to do with neuro. So there wasn't any real crossover either, which made that much easier. So like as the guideline co-chair, I was the co-chair when I moved positions, right? We talked about it and I said, I can definitely, you know, bow out if you need me to. But when you look at the guidelines, none of the guidelines that I shepherd through had anything to do with anything that I work on in my industry life, right? So it would be really hard to say that I had a true conflict of interest or that I couldn't do the job well. I think where you get into the gray is when there is a lot of crossover between, let's say I did go to a neuro ICU sort of drug or device or whatever. I think it probably would not have worked out for me. I also think as a new clinician, if you're in the industry side, I don't think you're ever going to be able to get on some of those committees unless there's a need to have an industry-sponsored participation. Again, I think I was very unique in this position.
First of all, right, like how much overlap is there? It's easier if the two parts of your life don't meet at that point. But also, any of that work you're doing now is presumably built upon that prior experience you have, not on your industry work now. So someone whose whole career was in industry, they're not going to have those opportunities unless specifically that is, you know, what the role called for. So it's like they could both coexist, but not sort of not at the same time. So if you wanted to build the one before the other, that would make the most sense.
I think if you went straight into industry, that those doors would not have been available or open. I think it was just because of the trajectory. And again, like I just mentioned before we started this call, I would say 90% of the critical care clinicians at WashU Barnes Jewish Hospital left after I did for industry to go do the exact same thing that I did. So they were also able to do a similar trajectory. You know, they were sitting on boards or writing papers or part of, you know, guidelines, et cetera, even after their transition. Again, because of they had similar background to what I did as well. So I don't think it was exclusive to me, but I do think that that's probably going to be more common as we start seeing healthcare professionals in the clinical space and academic space transition over to industry.
Do you think that it would be straightforward for you to return to clinical work at some point? Would that be an easy thing to transition back, or would it be difficult?
No, that would be awful. I have nightmares about it. I have been out for 5 years. I'm not even kidding you. I have nightmares that somebody comes to me and asks me how much, whatever I should put heparin or Bival, or one of my friends just wrote a paper on, I don't know, tirofiban or something in stroke. And I was just like, I'm like, tirofiban, like, why are we doing that? Right? I'm 5 years out. I know what the drug is, but in stroke, this is a 500-year-old drug. And then I get sweaty armpits, and then I'm like, oh my God, I'm going to have to dose something. Yeah, I'm not going
back. The answer
is
no, because of the time that you've spent out, you've gotten rusty. You've lost, facility with the things you're not doing every day. Not because someone, wouldn't hire you. It's just hard to pick something up that you've put down for a while.
And I think critical care and neuro, all of those things change so rapidly, right? And if you're living in it, if you're the one making those changes, if you're the one doing the research, if you're the one educating on the changes, it just comes as second nature. I would have to literally go back and learn what has happened in the trajectory over the last 5 years.
Right.
Oh, no. No, man. No way, Jose.
That's a hard thing for some people to hear, though, because they're thinking, if I were to try this, it might be a one-way door. Do you think you would have considered something like continuing to work part-time, a little bit clinically to sort of keep a toe in the game?
No. I was burnt out. I needed a change.
Okay. But let's say you weren't sure, you're like, oh, I want to kind of test these waters, but I don't want to just give up forever on.
I am not even sure that would be possible.
Yeah.
To have an academic / clinical presence and also be industry. Yeah. I feel like that there would be a conflict, and I don't know that, I don't think that you could do it. I think the only way you may be able to do it would be to work as a pharmacist anyway, maybe as a traditional pharmacist, right? In the actual pharmacy and not as clinical, because I do think you could be biased, and I just don't think that that would work. So yeah, no, I don't know how that would work.
Okay.
I could be wrong. There could be people out there that are doing both industry and working clinical.
Maybe like you said, if there's a big separation in the type, like you're working for Stryker talking about replacement knees or something like that, and it's not something that comes up in the ICU.
Maybe. I just don't think either entity would employ one over with a contract together. I just don't think that would work.
Yeah. So, if someone's out there this is exactly what my life needs, how do they find these opportunities? I mean, again, maybe you're in a little bit of a unique situation because you had such a long career and, probably a lot of opportunities for networking. But I also have the feeling these are often not the kind of jobs that you find on ZipRecruiter or whatever. I mean, maybe, but I don't know how competitive they are and how specific the needs are, because I think those are the kind of jobs where people often come by through, word of mouth.
So like I mentioned earlier on, when I was like, oh, I'll kind of explore and see what's out there, and I put my CV on LinkedIn and would apply for certain jobs that came up on LinkedIn that I thought, oh, that territory is in my, is great for me, or that therapeutic area is what I'm interested in or have an expertise in. And I would say out of 25 initially applications that I submitted, I got zero interviews. And it goes back to the fact that I had no industry experience. And it's really recruiters that are looking at these initial CVs, right? And when they see that they don't have 2 to 3 years of experience, then they just throw you out. Whether you have 25 years in the ICU or not, doesn't matter. So the way that then I kind of pursued it at that point was I did keep, as I mentioned also earlier, I did have relationships with a lot of these pharmaceutical companies, just because I did think, and I still do think, that partnering with clinicians and industry is really important. Just because we can't know everything, and as a clinician, and you're bringing value, and then it's the clinician's job to decide where that value lies and if they're going to use it on their patients or not. So I started reaching out to pharmaceutical companies that I worked closely with, including places like UCB, because, of course, we treat a lot of status epilepticus. So we've done a lot of their research for status on other AEDs, so different companies that I'd worked with, and just reached out directly to them, and because I had a relationship with them. And then, of course, they're like, oh, my gosh, you're jumping ship. You're coming over to the industry side. So then, of course, a plethora of people find out that you are looking at industry, and then you get job offers left and right. So it is a little bit different pathway. But again, if you've burnt those bridges or not created those bridges with industry from academic, it could be a little bit more difficult. I do think that those initial, what they're looking for, though, the recruiters, I do think, like I was saying also, is I think that's shifting again from, oh, we like someone with no experience, we want to mold them, we want to groom them, to now, oh, well, maybe we should look at these more experienced people because they do bring something different to the table. So I think that is changing a little bit. So it was a little bit of a interesting pathway to figure out where I wanted to land.
I don't know if you know the answer to this, but, you know, do you think positions like this, and maybe they're not all the same, but are they very competitive? Like, is it relatively feasible for someone to get into this kind of work if they decide that's what they want? Or is it like, no, listen, deciding that is just the first step. I mean, there's a lot of hurdles, and there's not that many of these things, and there may be a lot of other people who want it too. Or maybe it depends, you know, maybe they're those, you know, jobs for new grads are one matter, but maybe it's a different job where they're looking for someone with a lot of experience.
I do think it's competitive. That's a great question. I do think it's competitive, but I do think there are lots of positions that are out there that are being filled by people who probably aren't maybe necessarily as qualified as someone coming out of the academic / clinical space. And I do think that it could be a good transition. So, yeah, I do think it's competitive. But once you make your mind up, I think you can always find something, right? It might be a territory that's not perfect for you. It might be a little bigger, might be a little smaller. It might be a drug that's not in your space. Like I said, when I moved over to the industry side, I didn't even have a neuro drug at the time, right, in my repertoire with the industry. And that's what I came from, right? So you might not be specific to what you're an expert in, but you can learn it, right? It's a therapeutic area you can learn and you think is interesting. So, yeah, I think there are lots of jobs that might not be your perfect fit, but once you, this is the other thing too, is once I had my first 6 months or even just had MSL at all in my CV, which is still apparently out in the ether, right, on LinkedIn, once a recruiter figures out my expertise, I probably get 10 offers a day in LinkedIn to connect with a recruiter for an MSL position. Oh, I saw your, you know, whatever on LinkedIn. I see you have a neuro expertise. I see you have a critical care expertise. I see you're in St. Louis. I see. And then the world is your oyster. I literally get 10 job offers or at least opportunities a day.
Yeah, so, that's a great point. I mean, people have to remember that if you're talking about changing careers, even to one with a connection to your prior one, you may have to expect taking a couple steps back. You may not be going straight into your dream job, just like before. You may have to sort of work your way up, if that's the word, at least expecting to have one or two changes, something as kind of your entry position to learn this new job and kind of learn the ropes and get some experience, and then maybe moving from there into the exact area you'd rather work or the better job or whatever.
Absolutely. And, you know, I do think with the industry side too, you know, there is a lot of change. There's a lot of unknown. Certainly, it's very regulated. Those are the rules, right? There's guardrails to go by. But you never know. Like, my company was just acquired, and now we're in a transition over to another company. And you just have to also be able to roll with those, right? It's not like WashU and UVA and, you know, these larger academic centers get bought by people, right? So, you know, you're going to be with that company forever. And I think you just have to figure it out. And those new companies might say, hey, we don't want to pursue this therapeutic area that you're in anymore. Would you like to move over, or we're going to dissolve this, right? And then you're kind of back at your, the beginning. But I do think, again, once you have a little knowledge of the space, people want you like crazy.
What, and I don't know how, you know, free you would feel to share this, but are there any you know, negatives you found with this change, things that are not, you know, you liked it better before, or it's, you know, you wish it were different, either that were a surprise or maybe you expected it to be that way.
So I miss teaching. Now I'm still able to teach because as I go out and chat with healthcare providers about the therapeutic areas and or our drugs and where they fit in that therapeutic area and where I would use it, I do get a little education that way. But I really miss the day-to-day, the students, the residents, the fellows, teaching them how to take care of the patients. I really do. That's one part that I still to this day miss, in that relationship. I miss research. Now, I'm a really good starter. I am the best starter. I have the best ideas. I know exactly how I want to get them done. And then once I finish it, I'm a terrible finisher. Like, I don't want to publish it because I know the results. I hate writing, all the things. And when you get over on this side, it's not so much about doing the research unless you're looking at sponsored trials. And those are really big and you have a lot of help and it's less about one institution and a group of patients, but and it's more about finishing it. And I'm a terrible finisher. I don't want to say I'm a terrible finisher, but that's just not my strong suit. So, you know, it is changing now from trying to figure out how to answer a problem and or find an answer to a gap in the literature versus helping people get these projects over the finish line. I'm not saying that we don't have any input as far as best way to fill gaps and how we can change the products so that they might fit into, or we can research it for certain other areas where there is a gap. But it's a lot more finishing, I think, than initiating.
As we kind of wrap up here, I'm curious your advice for people who are going to interact with representatives from private industry. And, you know, this probably comes up more outside of the ICU, you know, in offices and things where there are still drug reps coming by and that sort of thing. But, you know, you see people at conferences and so on. And I personally do find it difficult sometimes knowing how to even sort of have a conversation with these people, because kind of in the same way that you talk to a car salesman, you know, everything they tell me might be true, but I know there's a reason they're telling it to me. If bias is the word, they're coming from a certain place. There's a reason that they're there. And I sometimes struggle to figure out how to sort of parse this, and it's almost easier to just to avoid it altogether. Now that you're on the other side of that, I mean, how do you recommend people kind of have this relationship, whether it's a one-off one, like they bump into them, or if they have a relationship that's ongoing with, I guess, people like you, you know?
Again, as another amazing question, I could not agree more. I was probably very similar in that side. Like, yes, I did have a relationship with certain people. I would have them come to my office. I would chat with them, especially if it was a drug that I wanted to use or understand or know more about. And then you do meet those individuals on the industry side that you do have trust in as well. So I understand what you're saying. At the same time, and I'm not saying that a lot of medical on the industry side, we all have some kind of agenda, right? Because if the company doesn't make money, then we don't make money, right? So yes, there is an agenda. The same time, if you can find people though in the medical space on the industry side that you somehow figure out that their whole purpose is to do better for patients, right? And I think that comes across as you have a conversation with them. The other thing too, though, is by missing, let's say you're at a conference and you're in the exhibit room and you're like, I'm just going to walk around and get free crap and fill up my little goodie bag and I'm not going to talk to anybody because I feel like it's weird, right? Well, you might miss the fact that there's a new propofol that just came out that doesn't cause hypotension if you didn't walk past it, and because it might not be coming out for 6 months. Or you might miss the fact that there's a new clovidipine that does the same thing. Or you might miss the new whatever that's coming out, a new paralytic, right? Like, there's a lot of things that are happening behind the scenes. And what you can do is have a conversation with their medical person, understand, well, why would you want a clovidipine 2.0 that doesn't cause hypotension? Let's see what the data looks like, right? Or have a conversation, and then you'll be able to tell which of these medical science liaisons actually know what they're talking about and want you to put this in your tool belt to be used on the right patient, or they're more of a salesperson and they're here just to push their drug, right? Because I think every drug that is being developed or comes out, there's a place for it. It might only be used once in 6 months and it might be used first line on every patient. But I think the reason the drugs are developed are with cause, right? And I think understanding a little bit more, and is it a drug that I want to use? And then talk to that medical science liaison, find out more about the way they feel and interact about that space. And then I think continue those relationships moving forward. And then more than likely, they'll end up moving into a different space, and then you'll interact with them in a different capacity somewhere else on another drug.
Yeah. I guess one of the ways that I sometimes find useful to view those interactions is it's like going to court. When there's a trial, there's somebody whose job it is to advocate for both sides, you know, the prosecution and the defense. And the prosecution's lawyer may believe whatever. I mean, their personal, you know, gestalt view may be that the person is innocent or guilty or whatever. But the game we're playing today, they have a certain role in, and their role is to advocate a certain side and to give it the best case they can, to pitch it in the most favorable light. That may mean not saying everything. That's not their job, if some things that are, you know, not as favorable to them. But someone else's job is to make that argument. And if you kind of view it that way, and you know, like, the point of this conversation is to get the propofol pitch, and it's not the final word. After this, my job is to find, you know, the other case, the other argument, and then together they'll mix around in my brain and I'll make a decision. Now, it may be a little harder to find that. It's not like if you find the Pfizer booth across the hall is the anti-Pfizer booth, but there is always someone with an opinion, you know, especially, you know, criticizing industry. There's always people who have opinions. So, you know, go find those cases and then you kind of end up in a good place. You probably do end up with more information there than if you're like, I'm just going to ignore what the company are saying.
100%.
Because they probably have something to say. And I guess it's also, just to be really transparent, it's not like the people in academics and clinical spaces and stuff are like bias free.
Right.
We just have our own biases that are sort of more subtle. They're, you know, cognitive biases. They're personal ones. Oh, I did this and a patient died. This drug sucks. Or I've done this for 20 years. I believe that it's good. It's part of me. Or I wrote a paper on this. Or, I mean, they get into much harder to perceive things. But viewing like one type of person, where they're coming from, as very pure and neutral and the other as inherently biased, it is probably a bit much. We're all, you know, humans.
And I think you will miss, I think you, there are opportunities, I think, out there to talk with industry, because we are developing stuff. You know, I just was at a meeting last week with our team, our research and development team, and we're trying to come up with new molecules all the time that will fix a problem where maybe there are things there, but it only masks or treats the symptoms of the problem, but doesn't treat the problem, right? Or get to the crux of the pathophysiology of whatever's happening. So industry really is working to try to fix these. Now, you know, I mean, there's been these major over the last, 10 years or so, right? We can cure hepatitis now. There's genomic cures for certain CF patients, right? So, and who's leading that? The industry is leading those. So I think talking with industry as well, you can see what's kind of coming out. The other thing too is if you have ideas, right? That's also our job on the industry side, is to listen, right? You guys are the boots on the ground now. You're the clinicians. You guys are the ones who know where you need something. Go talk to your industry partners and say, develop me something for this. Why aren't we looking at X, Y, and Z, right? And then that alerts this company, and then we can start doing some market research. We can start looking around. We can start seeing, is anyone else developing? I will also tell you that a lot of industries do work together on things behind the scenes before they're ever launched, before a Pfizer says, or an AZ or an Apotex or whatever says that they own a drug and they're going to launch it. There's a lot of collaboration and partnerships that go on behind the scenes to make these drugs amazing. And then the job is once you launch it is for the healthcare provider to figure out where you want to use it. Where is it best in your patient populations, right? And that's all going to be based on efficacy, cost, coverage, all the things, right? So I think there's a lot more that goes on in the industry than even academics or even I understood before I moved over to the other side.
Yeah, it's almost like childishly simplistic to have this view that like treating patients is this noble thing and the people who make money are like an evil empire, because it's such a necessary collaboration. We couldn't do any of what we do without people developing drugs and devices and so on. They have their own interests. I mean, you know, we shouldn't just give them our pocketbook and the keys to the kingdom or whatever. But unless your view is that this company is so evil, we can't support them in any way, and therefore you shouldn't work for them or talk to them or whatever. But that's such a strong view, because then if they didn't exist, then no one is making your propofol, and then you have to live right in the world without that. So, you know, we all have to kind of play our part.
And I think collaboration is the way to go, and partnership. And again, you know what? There's bad clinicians and there's probably bad pharmaceutical companies or bad industry partners, right? So not everyone's great. Not everyone's perfect. I think, most people, though, I want to believe, have the patients at mind no matter what. And I think I'd really like to go back and make sure everyone's patient-centric. And that goes for hospital administration, right? Like, they're not perfect either, and they're not patient-centric, even though they say they are. So I think everyone can point a finger at every place in, I think, healthcare and say, you're not great, you're not necessary. But I think we are all necessary, and we should all be collaborative and partner together.
Brian, what else should we say?
Well, it's interesting. One of the things that I've been thinking about and that I kind of want to ask I don't think we've talked about, is I have known some people over the years. I've had some friends, and actually I have some family members who are quote unquote drug reps or device reps, right? Which is a little bit different, I think, than what you're talking about doing, because they tend to be more straight sales. Am I right in that?
Correct. Yes. But I will partner with my sales reps, right? And sales reps and device reps, I'm not sure exactly what their guidelines are, but they can only say certain things like that are on label, that are promotional in the sense, whereas I'll partner with the salespeople, but I bring the medical side to it, right? I can bring the full breadth of the picture. I can talk about where this drug or device or whatever manage or marries up essentially to either the competition, why it's better, why it's worse, where I might use it, et cetera. So yes, we're not reps, and I don't get paid at all or whatever based on sales. I have no sales numbers. I have no quota that I have to make as far as sales. That's all the commercial side. I am only the medical support.
Well, and that's kind of what I was going to get at, because the folks that I know who do this or who have done this, and to my knowledge, none of them that I know personally have a medical background, right? That they are more salespeople. Like, if they weren't doing this, they would be selling, washers and dryers or cars or whatever. But they all say that, one of the big downsides of that job is that how they get paid, right? That it's a potential upside. If you do really well, you have a good client list and you're a person who can sell. You can do really well, but I've known several people who have said, I'm really struggling. I'm going to probably have to get a different job because I for whatever reason, right? Maybe they're not good at sales. Maybe they have a bad, area or
territory,
whatever.
I knew
one guy who had a lot of, personal stuff going on in his life. And he was like, I just can't always be at the hospital at 5 a.m. every morning to start seeing clients. And I need a job where I just get paid for doing my job, not for how, aggressive I'm hunting, so to speak. Right.
Right.
And I've known people who have said, I would be interested in getting into industry, but I can't do that. Right. I can't live on a commission. So you're saying that what you do is not like that. You're not tied to anything like that. You just basically go in and you do your job and you get paid like any of us do. Right.
Yep. Like a salary. And to really, I'm not saying that a medical person couldn't go over and do sales. You absolutely could, but you would be on the commercial side. But this position, this more medical science liaison, pharmacovigilance, research and development, there is a hard wall between medical and commercial, right? It's not like you can't partner and work together, because sometimes the salespeople need that medical support for their clients, right? So that you can have a real conversation. And sometimes it's way beyond. And again, I don't want to say this sounds negative to salespeople, but it's not. They just have a different skill set. But sometimes the questions are more pathophysiologic or higher than the level than they've been educated. Sure. So you need to bring somebody in who has that higher level of knowledge to be able to have those true interactions. Now, if that closes the deal, great. If it doesn't, it doesn't matter to me, because then I come back on my little medical side and I'm still over here. So we collaborate, but we do so in a very stringent manner. And I have no knowledge of sales numbers. I have no knowledge of territory numbers and who's making numbers and who's not. Like, that is so not compliant. And I think that's the way it's supposed to be. I don't have to make any numbers. Maybe sometimes some pharmaceutical companies do have for their liaisons certain numbers of touch points or insights from certain number of clinicians in a month or whatever. But so far, that is not something that any of my companies have said. They're really just sort of like, you know what, your job is to support us from a medical standpoint, whatever that is. And obviously, we capture that, document what we're doing, of course, but I don't have any metrics specific to number of calls I have to make or et cetera.
Gotcha.
Yeah, we probably shouldn't lump together every job that you could have for one of these businesses. I mean, they're all going to differ. Right. So probably what's important is when you look at a job is to understand, how are they evaluating you? Is that linked to your compensation? Is it something you're okay with? Or, I mean, can you stomach what they're talking about? Or, like, can you live that life?
I really don't know anybody in my space, like on the medical, like that has gone to sales from like... I have heard of, and very rarely do people go from sales then to the medical. They seem to be very different partners.
That makes sense. Different skill sets, probably.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I guess we could probably wrap it there. Very interesting conversation.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think a very sort of adult one, for, you know, the kind of one that, you know, when someone is like in school, they'd be like, I don't even want to listen to this topic. And then as they go on, and I could see that young person looking at the older version of themselves and being like, What a sellout, or like, why are you even, you know, what have you become? But it's really not that. It's just not being so simplistic. I mean, a lot of that perspective was based around not knowing a lot about these different roles and the work that they're doing and what they want and what the world's all about, and not even wanting to know. There's a certain purity in just viewing, you know, honestly, in doing certain kinds of jobs and viewing it as like a noble calling or something like that, and viewing it something else as being the opposite of that. It, you know, I think some people are getting a lot of their self-worth out of that. And hey, don't let me take away your self-worth, but I think there may be other things you can do in life also that would make you happy.
I agree.
Well, and I think it's interesting, yeah. You know, I mean, I assume, Brandon, you get paid, right? Like, I mean, I get paid for my job, right? but I think that there is this little bit of, I don't know, we feel like it's weird to do a job, quote, for money. Like, I mean, that's what's one of the main reasons I do my job is for money. So yeah, it's not terribly altruistic what we do either.
That's right. Yeah. The different things you could be doing are more similar in a lot of ways than we'd like to accept. You know, going to the ICU and seeing patients is a business.
Well, exactly. Kind of business, and that's what I tell students, right? I do, in all seriousness, that you need to think of this as a job, because that's what it is. If you start thinking of it as your identity or your calling or whatever, you're setting yourself up for trouble, because you can't live up to this superhuman ideal that you're somehow above just a normal person doing a job.
Yeah, and talking about burnout, I think that's the source of some of that. People are like, oh, I thought this was like, I joined the Justice League and I'm saving the world. And then they turn out, a few years later, actually it's a job working for a business.
You know, I do think, though, to be a critical care clinician, you do have to have some of that, I'm I am trying to change the world mentality, or I am trying to save lives, because you are. You walk in every single day with a kind of superpower. You know how to take care of these patients. And if you make the right decision, it could save a life, right? Like, so I think you do have to have a little bit. Yes, it is a job, but you also have to be passionate about it, because it's a lot of hours. It's a lot of time. It's a lot of heartache. It's a lot of blood, sweat, and tears. So I also wouldn't want to take away that sense of pride for doing what you're doing in the ICU, because it is a commendable job and it is a hard job.
Yeah, no, you're right. And I think that part of the reason people kind of view it differently is because they feel that they are in some ways making sacrifices. They're doing maybe stressful work, long hours, and so on. Whereas they could be doing easier work, maybe making more money, getting kind of more bang for their buck there. And they're choosing to do that because it's to benefit someone. And that may be true. You know, maybe they could have gone into a non-medical field altogether and, you know, rob banks or whatever, but they're too moral for that. But I guess the question becomes like, so what of it? Okay, you made that choice. Do you have to do that forever? Because that is the more moral self-sacrificing thing. Is it like a quantity thing? Like you did 25 years helping people and, you know, working long hours, et cetera, et cetera. So like you need to do 26. It's, you know, it's like I was talking to my wife at one point, should we have a third kid? Because the first two are good. Okay, well, so is three better than two? Is four better than three? Is that right, how this right. works? Like, is it? And that's, it doesn't, the fact that there may be truth to that doesn't mean that you have to do it forever or in fact that you had to do it ever. It's just, it's something to think about.
Agree.
All right. Well, thanks for this chat. I would remind everyone that we're not representing any of our individual institutions here, I don't think we even mentioned Teresa's, so that makes that easy enough. And obviously, it's just some general ideas, but I hope it's opened some brain light bulbs for people and at least kind of expanded how people are looking at the world. We'll talk to you guys next time.